The origins of this paper is that we started working on how to, you know, trying to give a proof for this random partial checking technique that was proposed by Jacobson, Ewells, and Rivest. And we ended up finding a flaw in this scheme. And then when we looked at the electronic voting system used in Norway, it turned out that they were using a mixnet where kind of similar ideas were applicable. So that's the results here. So let me begin by putting this into context. Where do we use mixnets? So there are different types of voting systems, but the things that I'm mostly interested in are those where a mixnet is used as a component. And those systems basically have three steps. First, you generate a joint public key. And then the voters form encryptions. They form ciphertext of their votes using this public key and some kind of verifiable submission scheme. And by submission scheme, I mean everything else that you put on top of this. So this could be, you know, pre-printed ciphertext, like in Prêt-à-voter, or it could be a voting machine where you go and this will print the ciphertext on paper and you do cast or audit or something like that. And on top of this, you need non-malleability properties or proofs of knowledge of the plaintext and stuff like that. But I'm not going to care about it today because it's kind of beside the point. Okay? And then what you do, you feed this to a mixnet, and the mixnet simultaneously permute and decrypt these ciphertexts. Right? So the mixnet is really like when you were voting as a kid, you wrote the candidates' names on pieces of paper, you put it in a hat, you shook the hat, and you unfolded all the papers, and that's the result of the election. That's really what the mixnet is doing. So slightly more, detailed, we have this protocol, a mixnet. This protocol will output the public key. It will accept some ciphertext as input, and it will output the plaintext. And here, this pi here is a permutation of those indices. So it's, we want this protocol to work in this way. and this notion was introduced by Chaum in 81 or 82. And actually, the types of schemes used in practice, they are so-called re-encryption mixnets. So these are schemes that are based on homomorphic cryptosystems. But before, it's a mixed audience here, so I'm really taking things slowly. I want you, most of you at least, to get the idea here, right? So let us just recall what the cryptosystem is. So this is a public key cryptosystem. So you have Alice and Bob, and Bob wants to be able to receive messages sent secretly by Alice, or by anybody else for that matter. So Bob generates two keys, the secret key and the public key. And then when Alice wants to send a message, she uses the message and the public key and feeds that into the encryption algorithm to produce a ciphertext, and the ciphertext is sent to Bob, who decrypts it using his secret key, right? And this looks good, but it's actually not good enough for electronic voting because it's deterministic, the way it's described here, right? So you cannot have a deterministic scheme when you have very few plaintexts. So in voting, you might have only yes or no or two different candidates, right? And then it would be easy to tell who voted for what by simply comparing the ciphertext. Right? So what we need is a probabilistic cryptosystem. We need to add this additional randomizer parameter. And that will solve the problem because now essentially all the ciphertexts will look different. Even if you encrypt the same message many times, they will all look different and be indistinguishable. Okay. The other property we need is this homomorphic property. So it really means that, if you take two ciphertexts and you multiply them, you get a new ciphertext, which is, contains the product of the original plaintext. And obviously, if we want to explain exactly what it is, we have to define this multiplication operation. But, for this talk, it doesn't matter. So, just believe me, there is such an operation if you haven't seen it yourself. And this is really an amazing property if you think about it. I mean, encryption means to garble something. So you have two things which are completely garbled, and then you can do some algebraic operation, and you get something new which is garbled that contains something. It's really amazing, I think, actually.
Wouldn't homomorphic addition be enough?
What do you mean?
Homomorphic encryption works pretty well with addition as the
priority. Yeah, but that's kind of a... It's just a notation. If you want to think about it in terms of addition or multiple, it's a group, right? So it's a group operation. But in practice, there is a difference, right? It's a matter of encoding stuff into this group. That's where it matters, right? Anyway, we also want to talk about the randomness. So the randomness is also part of this relation. It has a similar thing, and note here I'm using additive notation and multiplicative notation. I'm just following the literature here. And the good thing about this is that you can re-encrypt ciphertext. So if you have a ciphertext, an encryption of M0, using some randomness R0, then you can multiply this ciphertext by an encryption of 1 using randomness R1. Okay? And this will give you a new ciphertext of the same plaintext, but now with fresh randomness. And because this is a group, this new ciphertext will be independently distributed, and it will look like a fresh encryption of M0, right? So the point here is that even if you yourself encrypted two different messages and gave the ciphertext to me, if I re-encrypt them and give them back to you in some random order, you cannot tell which is which, even if you produced the original ciphertext. Okay? That's exactly the property that we're going to use here for the mixnet. Okay, so a re-encryption mixnet, you can view it as follows. You have this joint key generation phase. And then what you do, you re-encrypt and permute all the ciphertexts simultaneously. And finally, you decrypt using a distributed decryption protocol. Right, so note that compared to the outline that I gave on the first slide, here I have separated the decryption from the re-encryption. Okay? And if we want to depict this, we can view the mix servers as organized in a chain. So this is Chalm's idea, that you organize the mix servers in a chain, and then they process the input list of ciphertext step by step. So the first server takes this list, it re-encrypts and permutes all the ciphertexts to produce a new list. And then the next server does the same thing. It takes each ciphertext, re-encrypts it, and permutes the order of those ciphertexts. And it continues like that. And eventually you have a list, which is then permuted and re-encrypted by all the servers. And then you feed this into this distributed decryption protocol. And the focus of this talk is the red stuff, right? So the attacks, they don't care about what's going on here. Yeah. Okay, so let's look closer at one of those servers. So what's going on here? It's given a list of ciphertexts as input, and it has to produce this output list of ciphertexts. And I told you that it re-encrypts and permutes the ciphertext. So what does it mean? You have some input ciphertext, and then you can re-encrypt it by multiplying by an encryption of 1 using some fresh randomness, RJI, right? So that's, for each server, picks its own randomness. And then you permute all those. This gives you some set of new ciphertexts, CJIs. And then you form your output list from these ciphertexts. So that's what's going on inside, for one of those steps. Okay. So you have this chain, and now we know what's going on in each box. So what happens if one mixer is malicious? Then it can replace everything, right? So that was the original, the drawback, actually, of Chalm's original mixnet, which is what's decryption-based. How do we know that these servers are doing what they should? So the idea is to use old ideas from very early in the history of crypto to simply force them to do that, right? So you would use a proof, So preferably you should use a zero knowledge proof, but actually it might be okay to use something weaker. And that's exactly what was proposed a few years ago. I don't know exactly how many years ago, maybe 5 years ago, I don't remember, by Puigalli and Gouache. And these are two people from Zytel, the company that is selling voting equipment. And they provided the technology for the election scheme in Norway. So I will say something about that in the conclusion. Okay, so what is kind of proof that they're using? Well, the idea is to simply, you know, look at the input ciphertext and the output ciphertext of a given server, and you simply multiply all of them. And because multiplication is invariant under permutation, what you should get if you do that is that the output product should be a re-encryption of the input product. Okay? That's a basic idea. So clearly this should hold. If the server behaved honestly, this should hold. Okay? It's just using the homomorphic property. The problem with this is that it's not really a proof, because what you can do, you know, if you're a bad guy, you can take the first ciphertext and you replace it by multiplying by something. Some junk or something that you want to use to attack the scheme. And then you take another ciphertext and you multiply by the inverse of that. So now if you take the product of those modified ciphertexts, it will give the same product as the unmodified ciphertext. Right? So your modification will not show up in the test. You will not be detected. Right? So this is clearly, you know, taking the product like that is clearly not good enough, right? So the idea of these people is then to say, well, suppose we randomly partition the input ciphertext into blocks of equal size, and then we do this test within each block. Okay? So some verify will come along and say, well, I'm going to use this partitioning, and then the mix server has to point out how it mapped the ciphertext within each block in the output. Not individually, so there's no, you know, clear correspondence for each ciphertext, but as a block, viewed as a block, he has to tell how they mapped. And then within each block, you apply this, you know, product idea. So more formally, what you do, you pick this random partitioning, these I sets, and then you ask the server to compute the corresponding output blocks, the output sets, and then for each such input and output block, you take the product of all the ciphertexts, and then you prove that the product of the output ciphertext is a re-encryption of the product of the input ciphertext. Okay, so the idea is that you know, if I'm a bad guy, what can I do? Right, I have to modify at least two ciphertexts to get away with it, because the product must match. Right, so I need to modify somewhere. And then I need to hope, you know, the idea is that I hope that my other modification ends up in the same block. And if it does, then it's not noticed. Okay, so, you know, intuitively the probability that you can get away with cheating is 1 divided by b. So if you have plenty of blocks, it's probably good, right? Okay, so here's an illustration of this scheme again, right? So you have some input ciphertext, you have some output ciphertext, and the arrows is the permutation that you actually used. Okay, so most of it will remain hidden, even after the proof. Okay, so the verifier comes along and he partitions the input into red, blues, and greens. And then the server has to point out, you know, where each color mapped. Okay, so note that it doesn't reveal those black arrows, it simply points out, you know, it colors the output. Okay? And then within each color, you prove that the products match, in the sense that they are re-encryptions of each other. Okay? That's the scheme. Okay, so now let's look at some attacks, and I will actually only explain one of the attacks, like a simplified version of this. And then you can look in the paper if you you're interested. Okay, but before I do this, I need to recall an old attack by Fitzman. So this attack was presented in the context of mixed network. Okay, of mixed network where you don't require where you don't enforce non-malleability of the inputs. So if you have a homomorphic or a malleable cryptosystem that you use just plainly, then this attack is applicable. Okay, that was the message of Fitzman. Okay, so the idea of this attack is that if I want to break the privacy of the first ciphertext C1, I will, as a bad guy, I will submit C1 raised to some random delta. And then I will simply wait for the mixnet to complete. And at the end, I will look for a correspondence, two ciphertexts that are related by this random number delta. And this will, with very high probability, uniquely determine M1. And then I know that, you know, C1 actually contains M1. So this scheme, you know, this attack is exactly what we're going to do, but we cannot do that from the very beginning because we have these submission schemes that forces us to use this non-malleable blah, blah, blah. And somehow you get Elgamal ciphertext out of it, which are fed into the mixnet. So we cannot use this attack directly, but we can kind of plug this attack in at a later stage during the mixing. So one observation that is important here is that suppose that some bad guy submitted encryptions of one, multiple encryptions of one. Okay, then the adversary knows how to re-encrypt each of those ciphertexts to all the other ciphertexts. They're all encryptions of one, right? And the adversary knows all the randomness. So he can do that. Okay? And what we want to do, we want to attack some ciphertext C. So that might be a ciphertext of some celebrity or a politician, somebody important that we really want to know what they voted for. And then we're going to introduce C raised to delta somewhere in the mixing. Okay? So here's the attack. M1 is going to define its output as follows. Its first output ciphertext is going to be its own corrupted input ciphertext times C raised to delta. So it's going to modify its own first ciphertext by multiplying it by C delta. And the second one is going to modify by raising it, you know, multiplying by C raised to minus delta. So those two are canceling out, right? That's the idea, okay? And the rest are untouched. It simply doesn't do anything with them. And all the other ciphertexts of good guys, he processes them correctly. Okay, so now the point is that if any two of its ciphertexts end up in the same block, then it claims the first and second of its outputs are re-encryption of those two ciphertexts that ended up in the same block. So the point is he's not committed to any particular permutation among his own ciphertexts. Okay? He can decide that later. Okay? And then he simply completes the Fitzman attack as before, to identify, you know, who voted, what the targeted voted for. Okay, so why is this a good idea? It's because of the birthday paradox. So if you have V equal to square root of B, roughly, then you will have a collision, meaning that you will have two ciphertexts of your own ending up in the same block. So fairly quickly you can do this attack. And then there is this variation of it, if you're allowed to corrupt two servers, then you can actually get away with only using that many voters. And when I say square root B of L, I really mean square root B of L-ish, like a factor of 3 or something. It depends on how well you want to complete the attack, right? But that's the idea, okay. And then we show with a somewhat different technique, we show that if you choose the parameter in a particular way, namely that the block size is bigger than the number of blocks. Like if you have this square relation, like it, then you can actually attack integrity as well. So you can replace up to square root of B ciphertext. But here the numbers are against us, right? So square root of B is a fairly small number, so it's not a very strong attack on integrity. Okay, and then I just want to mention, this is a teaser then for this first paper that you can find on ePrint, the crypto ePrint server, where we do similar stuff on this old paper, making mixnets robust for electronic voting by random partial checking. So this is a technique that was used in Civitas and also in a modified form in Scantegrity and in other unmentioned implementation that I've been given, I've been allowed to look at other people's implementation, and they all suffer from this flaw. Okay, so what is the conclusion here? Well, I think that, you know, for this particular scheme, this attack is still fairly weak. Right? It's not a catastrophic attack, but I don't think it's acceptable to have a scheme where you can do something like this for celebrities. Right? So if you start with 200,000 voters and a block size of 20, which is quite, it's very close to what they're using in Norway, then you need a few hundred ciphertexts, and then you can break the anonymity of a targeted voter. And those ciphertexts, you don't even have to modify the plaintiff. They can still vote. They don't have to give up the right to vote, those corrupted voters. But this attack is not directly, I want to say this very clearly, it's not directly applicable to the scheme in Norway, because they're using the mixnet in a particular way, and there are other stuff going on outside it. So you cannot do this attack, and you could do this attack, but then you have to violate their assumptions. So it can I can explain it offline. But my main punchline is this, and this is what I was talking about yesterday as well. I think really these proofs of security are necessary to trust the cryptographic protocol. And obviously then the proofs of security should mean that somebody wrote it down and other people read it and carefully studied it, or we have machine verification going on. Because a proof without readers is, it's good, but it's not good enough. So that's a crypto. And then there are other things going on, of course, that we have to worry about. But that's not my expertise. Yeah, that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you very much. Two comments. It's not sufficient because the assumptions you're making may not have been correct.
Yes, that's another reason.
Would you go back to slide 21, please?
Yes.
You've got B over L in there, but I over L. L is N over B, so that is the square root of B squared over N, which is B over the square root of N. Why, this seems to be unnecessarily obfuscated, or else there's a mistake somewhere.
Actually, on my first slide, I did it like you wanted. But I think this is more clear, because this L is going to be much smaller in practice.
Yeah.
So it gives a better feeling for what's going on, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. But
it's curious. But
yeah. Maybe you're right. Yep.
Thank you for the talk. So very nice. Your general point is well taken. I wondered if I could dive into the details of the attack, because I'm not sure if I understood the details. It sounded like, if I understood correctly, the threat model was you had some corrupted voters who were submitting particular ciphertext, and then a malicious mix that is then tampering with stuff. And I wondered if you could say a little bit about why we need the corrupted voters, why a malicious mix on its own couldn't mount this attack. So the kind of thing I'm envisioning is a malicious mix that picks one ciphertext and doubles it and picks the other ciphertext and halves it and then hopes those two ends up in the same block so that the multiplication test doesn't detect it.
So the point is that the point is this line, right? So if I'm the corrupted mixer, I'm the first mixer, and I want to do this kind of attack, right? The problem is that I need the liberty to decide on the permutation later, after the verifier gave me the partitioning. Because if I don't have this liberty, then I cannot exploit an arbitrary collision. Two ciphertexts of mine ending up in the same block. I don't know where to. If I don't have my own ciphertext, which I can re-encrypt in any way I like, then I'm kind of stuck with a particular permutation because I don't know the randomness.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yes. Yeah. Sure.
Could a malicious mix just let the permutation be whatever it is and just accept there's only a small chance these two ciphertexts have been corrupted with will end up in the same block? Maybe he gets lucky and then
the attack is
undetected. And, you know, it's not maybe it's only a small chance probability. I don't know what it is, B over N or whatever the number
one divided by B.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So is that kind of attack possible? Is there a reason describe the...
I think in practice, if you fail with probability, if you succeed with probability 1 divided by 1,000, that's probably good enough in practice because there would be severe punishment if you attempt to do that attack, right?
Okay. So
but the point here is that if you corrupt, if you do this attack, and you have square root of b voters, rough square root of b-ish, like 3 times square root of b or 4 times square root of b, then the probability of getting caught is very small. It's like 10% or something. And you can squeeze it by having, it gets squeezed very quickly if you just have a multiple of square root of b. That's the point, right? Okay. So you get away with it.
So let me see if I summarize. Yeah. You can tell me if I've got this right. It sounds like there's a simple attack that would succeed with low probability, like 1 in 1,000, and 999 in 1,000 times.
Yes.
I would get caught, or I'd have to make some excuses or something. The more sophisticated attack that you showed here allows the success probability to be essentially 1. And so you have essentially no probability of getting caught. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And the first attack is something that the authors were well aware of. It's not an attack. It's a property of the scheme, or like an expected property of the scheme. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Josh?
So if there are no other questions, let me ask a final, very quick question. This narrow form of the attack, could this be thwarted by further restrictions on what voters are allowed to submit so that the votes are basically checked and rejected if they are in this corrupted form?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. There are more technical details exactly what's going on, because what they're doing, they have different ways of choosing the partitioning for the different servers. So the first server, it's random. For the other ones, it's derived in a non-random way. Mm. That's very, very scary when I saw that. That's kind of the fast results are exploiting this, and the integrity attack also exploits. So it may well be possible that you can thwart this particular attack, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay.